end, boys and girls. That declaration of war has never been rescinded and never will. And this is Terrible Tommy in the bunker right here in north central Indiana on a beautiful day. Going to get up into the 80s today. Going to put on my thong, get my rubber tube, and jump in my creek here. Yeah, I may have to, I'll tell you. Hey, it is Wotan's Day, right? The 25th of May, 2016, dedicated to David Lane, who was murdered by federal goons at the prison here in Indiana. Well, I bet you're almost tired of hearing these interviews where people are asking me a million questions that you've heard most of the answers to before. Yeah, well, yesterday my lady and I, we went on an excursion to it's a Mennonite place where they've got all kinds of sales going on, and they sell everything from horses to pottery and everything else. Yeah. We went with the old people, the senior citizen bus. Yeah. Oh, man. But unfortunately, on our little bus, one of those airport buses, they put a retarded guy on there in a wheelchair with cerebral palsy. And he couldn't control his speech and so forth. And he'd rah, 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 like, you know, Frankenstein in one of those old movies. Enough to drive you crazy. It made me understand why National Socialism wanted euthanasia and so forth in Germany. Because people who are that bad of shape, there's nothing they can do. There's no way they can contribute to the efforts of the tribe at all. And they just become a total burden on society. And even more than that, their family. So, I feel awfully sorry for the people in that situation. On the other hand, until they get out from under the control of these churches and Christians who emotionally and psychologically force people to keep these totally beyond physical redemption people alive, it's going to continue. We've got quite a number of mongoloids around this area. See them almost every time I go out to any big affair, like a fair or circus or you name it. Those should be put down at birth. Now they have the equipment to tell what you've got, what the baby's going to be like. So they should be put down right away. Now, anybody that can contribute to the tribal effort, even though they're handicapped, is okay. But when people have nothing of value to contribute to the tribal effort, to the racial effort, then I believe in euthanasia, of course. So we thought we'd be smart and change buses. There were two buses, exactly the same kind of buses. So we got on the other bus coming back, and guess what? We had an untouchable Negro get on, and he was one of these blabbermouthed, yelling, screaming, trying to impress the old ladies. So all the way up, we had the retard screaming. All the way back, we had the Negro trying to make people think he was brilliant and a big jokester. So I don't know. Sometimes these senior citizen outings, I don't think they're all they're cracked up to be. Plus, you get to where you're going, it's supposed to be a place where a swap meet, garage sale situation, a giant swap meet. It's all Chinese junk shit. All new stuff. Chinese. There wasn't no regular garage sales or swap meet with all kinds of old antiques and stuff. And beyond that, just plain the kind of junk I like to go through. No, nothing but a massive amount of Chinese junk. Yeah, there they were selling thousands and thousands of dollars worth of that stuff that the profits are going to go right back into China, and they're going to be building railroads and new schools and all that kind of stuff while our stuff falls apart here in this country. Well, that's my comment on that. And so you can call me a grouchy old son of a bitch if you want to, but that's just the way I feel about it. Now we're going to get into one of my least favorite subjects, war. And we're up at, we've covered, three or four wars all the way up through the Spanish-American War, and now we're going into the First World War. Now, I hope you realize there never was a Second World War. The First World War never really ended. And the First World War, of course, laid the groundwork for guaranteeing the Second World War. People who say, well, that wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for Hitler. Well, that's bullshit, because if it hadn't been Hitler, the guy could have been Brown or Smith or Jones. Somebody was going to come up and had to come up to try to straighten out Europe. But Uncle Adolf, unfortunately, went off the rails too far, man. If he'd have stopped in, if he'd have stopped in 40 or 39, things would have been okay. Okay, so remember, the First World War started with one assassination. The First World War. I mean, just as many people died in the First World War as the Second World War. 55, 60 million people. A lot of people don't realize that. Plus, they were gassing white people all over the front. Yeah. Keep whining about the Jews being gassed. Whether how many of them that were gassed, I don't know. But in the First World War, massive numbers, tens of thousands of white men were being gassed. And some white civilians got a dose of that gas, too. Nobody talks about the horrible gassing of white Aryans. Well, here we go, the wonderful world of World War I. We shall not undertake a long discussion of the causes of the World War, but simply examine the reason for the participation in it of the United States on the side of the Allies. For the first time in history, the generation living a great war has been able to ascertain the facts regarding its origin. These facts, however, have not yet become the common property of the great masses, although they are gradually becoming evident to everybody. Now, you got to remember, this book was copyrighted in 1927, before the Second World War. A great many people are still influenced by the passions and hatreds aroused by the conflict. You know, they talk about allies all the time. Allies are usually picked not because of race, but because of economics. Race may have something, a little bit to do, but not as much as people think. The United States chooses allies according to what they can do for the military-industrial complex and the economic system. Otherwise, white countries, culturally and racially, have been fighting each other for a long, long time. Briefly stated, the causes of the conflict were trade rivalry between Great Britain and Germany, the scramble for territory officially in Africa, the conflict between Russia and Germany for the domination of the Balkan Peninsula, and the old inherited animosity between France and Germany. The accusation of soul guilt against Germany is held no longer by educated persons who have studied the facts, although there still are and will no doubt always be differences of opinion about minor matters. The immediate occasion for the opening of the hostilities in 1914 was the murder of Archduke Ferdinand, the heir to the throne of Austria-Hungary. This murder took place while he was in Bosnia. Interesting how that Bosnia keeps coming up. It's been a trouble spot for a long time. And, of course, that's Bosnia had become highly populated with Islamics, or white people who worship Islamics. And that's what caused the problem. The crime was committed by representatives of a Pan-Slavic organization working hand-in-hand with the Serbian government with a view of annexing Bosnia to Serbia. Maybe at that time Serbia or Bosnia was not so heavily populated with Islam. I don't know. Up to the 19th century, the Balkan Peninsula was owned by Turkey, but the last century has witnessed a gradual breakup of European Turkey on the Balkan Peninsula. In connection with this disintegration, Russia tried to gain territory at the expense of Turkey. Austria-Hungary also tried to penetrate the same area. A conflict was an inevitable consequence. This Balkan problem had been a source of trouble in Europe for a century. Still is, for that matter. The people of Serbia were Slavs and looked to Russia for support. In fact, Serbia was practically governed by Russian diplomacy. Austria-Hungary looked to Germany for support. In 1908, Bosnia, which was then a Turkish province, but had been administered by the Austria-Hungary since 1878, was annexed by Austria-Hungary. This act offended Serbia, who wished to annex it as part of the Pan-Slavic dream for dominion by Russia, Bosnia, Serbia, and the remainder of the Balkans. Just remember, man fights for territory, and he always has, and that's the name of the game. People say men fight for females. No, they fight for territory first. Once they have the domination of the territory, then they get the best females, usually. This annexation by Austria-Hungary defeated the Pan-Slavic dream and was a victory for Pan-Germany. Germany should have probably kept its nose out of it. Feeling became more and more acute when in 1914 the Archduke Ferdinand was killed. The incident was applauded by Serbia and the conflict followed. The details of the events in 1914 are too complicated to go into in our brief space, but popular accounts reaching the United States were from Allied sources and were correspondingly biased. In 1914, all Europe was divided into two great military camps, the Allied and the Central Powers. The following is the size of the principal armies of Europe in 1914. Germany, 806,000 soldiers. Austria, 370,000. Italy, 305,000. France, 818,000. Russia, 1,284,000. Belgium, 280,000. All Europe was equipped as a military machine, and the murder in Fort 1914 simply put the machinery in motion. It was an absurd fallacy to think that Germany was the only armed nation at the time, and to believe that Great Britain entered the conflict to defend Belgium is equally absurd. Well, they did that same thing in World War II. As early as only it was Poland in World War II. As early as 1911, Great Britain had made plans with France for marching an army through Belgium to Germany in the event of war with Germany. Belgium was regarded as part of the Allied powers. Great Britain was officially acknowledged to be false, her ostensible reason for entering the war, the protection of Belgium. Britain does that a lot, you know. Her reason was the struggle between rival imperialisms, which secret treaties later exposed and show clearly. However, we are concerned here only with the why the United States entered the war. Their three outstanding causes were interference with neutral trade, catch that, boys and girls, economic ties with the Allies, and Allied propaganda in the United States. Incidentally, that Allied propaganda was spread by Edward Bernays, who was the nephew of the German psychopathic doctor Freud. And he was the propagandist that spread the use of cigarettes in the United States. Edward Bernays. He was also the one who got everybody eating eggs and bacon, because before they had been separate dishes, but Bernays went to work for the meat people and got a propaganda for eating bacon. And so it evolved into bacon and eggs. But he was also a bastard, because most of the United States citizens didn't have any interest in going into World War I at all. Edward Bernays was contracted by government officials to go throughout the country, whistle-stopping, going all over the place, giving speeches on how we got to get into World War I. And of course, there's the old thing about the Germans bayoneting Belgian babies, and all that kind of nonsense that never happened. So Edward Bernays, a Jew, was more instrumental in getting the United States into World War I than almost anybody else as a propagandist. So the Jews should not complain about what happened to them in World War II, because they laid the groundwork with their crimes of World War I. Like I always say, when they say they find this art that was stolen by the Nazis from the Jews, and they get it back and give it to them or give them a lot of money, who do you think stole it from the regular people? The Jews during the Weimar Republic were stealing all this stuff from downtrodden, poor, bankrupt, working class and middle class people in Germany. So when the National Socialists came to power, they took it back. So anyhow, they don't tell the rest of the story. Soon after the war was declared in 1914, Great Britain placed mines in the North Sea and, with the aid of her navy, blockaded Germany and the adjacent neutral portions of North Europe. As a result, all goods going in that direction were captured. The United States protested, but Great Britain refused to yield the point, claiming it to be a military necessity, albeit illegal from the point of view of international law. Great Britain blockaded Germany by mines and cut off all foreign trade with Germany and neutral ports near Germany to prevent the entrance of goods into Germany. Well, you know what that causes. It causes famine and starvation, and there was quite a bit of it. Germany retaliated in February 1915 by employing the submarine to blockade Great Britain. One policy was legal as the other. Mr. Wilson protested, but neither side yielded. In no case in history has a nation at war observed the established rules if the rules conflict with military expediency. The United States has been no exception to this procedure, since the object of the warfare is the physical destruction of an opponent. Once you justify the war, you must justify any means employed to gain victory, including dropping atomic bombs. In protesting to Germany, we argued that the submarines could not warn ships to take off passengers before they were sunk, but neither could the mines planted by Great Britain. American ships kept out of the mine zones, but disregarded the submarine zones for reasons we shall explain later. The Lusitania, a British ship, was sunk by a submarine on May 7, 1915. 114 Americans lost their lives. We immediately protested, but the facts have shown that the Lusitania carried a large quantity of munitions of war. And I believe the even German government put an ad in the New York Times newspaper prior to that Lusitania sailing that they would be subject to attack by submarines because the ship was carrying arms. At the time the boat was sunk, a United States senator asked the Treasury Department for a bill of lading. He was told it had been turned over to the State Department. When the senator asked the State Department for a copy of the bill of lading in order to see what was on board, the State Department refused to disclose the contents on the grounds that it was to be kept for diplomatic correspondence. It was not known until after the war was over what had actually been on board the ship. Since then, it's been officially stated by the collector of customs, then in New York, that the Lusitania carried munitions of war. Besides, Germany had warned the passengers before getting on board that in all probabilities the ship would be sunk. This notice was officially published in the New York papers before the ship sailed. There's no question that the passengers had been given due warning. Whether the sinking was legal or not depends on the point of view. According to Germany, she did more than the law required her, warning before a ship left a harbor, which is rather better than being warned a few minutes before being sunk in mid-ocean. The British seized and searched the mails. United States officials below the rank of minister were searched by the British while traveling to and from the continent. Before the close of 1914, 31 cargoes of copper valued at $5.5 million had been captured by Great Britain, but the United States owners were compensated. Their seizure, however, was illegal. Early in 1916, Germany agreed to give up the use of the submarine, but on the condition that the United States makes Great Britain obey international law. We could not force Great Britain to abide by international law, and consequently, Germany resumed her submarine warfare in 1917, which was our official reason for entering the war. But this was only our legal excuse. The effective causes were our economic ties with the Allies. See that? It's always economics. That wasn't about race, about economics. The Allied propaganda in the United States also. We will examine these causes more carefully. Modern warfare is a conflict of economic resources as well as armies. The British Navy cut off all economic intercourse with Germany and the United States. In this way, the economic resources of the United States were in the hands of the Allies. American agriculture, credit, and industries soon became indispensable to the Allied cause. In 1915, an Anglo-French mission came to New York and secured a loan of $500 million. This money was left with various banks in New York for the purpose of buying supplies from America. So the supply makers and the gun makers and the armament makers here in the United States were making a bundle off of this problem in Europe. The Allied governments continued to borrow in the Wall Street, and these banks loaned England and France money with which to buy materials. Soon the House of Morgan became the purchasing agent of the Allies. The Morgan firm selected Edward R. Stettinus, president of the Diamond Match Company, as the purchasing agent. Mr. Stettinus selected 175 men to assist him in the task. They were soon purchasing supplies for the Allies at the rate of $10 million a day. By September 1917, the Morgan firm had purchased $3 million in merchandise and munitions for the Allies, in addition to selling of Allied bonds. That's another thing that Edward Bernays was doing, going across the country and giving speeches in small towns to get people to buy war bonds. When Kitchener became Minister of War in Great Britain in 1915, one of his first acts was to cable Charles M. Schwab of the Bethlehem Steel Company to come to England immediately. Schwab went and agreed to sell all the output of Bethlehem Steel Company to the British government. In less than 2 years, he shipped about $300 million worth of war material to England. See how war is big business, boys and girls? Big business. Nothing to do with race. 20 submarines were built and sent in parts to Canada, where they were assembled and sent across to England. This was done a year before the German submarine Deutschland came to the United States and was advertised as the first to cross the Atlantic. That comes from a book by John Moody, titled Masters of Capital, pages 162 to 172. American industry had become one with the Allies. Our greatest banking and industrial institutions had become dependent upon Allied victory, and Allied victory was dependent upon them. American industry became pro-Ally because the British blockade cut off our trade with Germany. Germany and Austrian agents such as Dumba, Karl Boyed, and Franz von Papen were expelled from the country because of their unneutral activities on behalf of the Central Powers. Patriotic societies such as the Navy League and the American Defense Society and the National Security League were all tied up financially with munitions plants. These societies were propaganda bureaus for preparedness and later for their entrance into the conflict. The 19 men who founded the Navy League had among their numbers representatives of the three manufacturers' armor plate in America, the Midvale, Bethlehem, and Carnegie companies. The Navy League was in practice the propaganda bureau of the three companies working together to sell armor plate. Modern warfare has become even more than a conflict of armies and of economic resources. Propaganda to secure popular support has become more and more necessary. Both sides of the European conflict made great efforts to present their propaganda before America, but the Central Powers failed primarily because of the British blockade. The Allies, on their side, had the cooperation of American business and easily accomplished their purpose. Professor Hayes, in his brief history of the Great War, says, quote, "The British resorted to every known device of propaganda, from employing Secret Service agents in New York to maintaining at Washington the great journalist Lord Northcliffe with a host of assistants as a publicity director for war propaganda. These propagandists had the cooperation of the bankers who had made loans to the Allies or had acted as purchasing agents. All this happened in 1916, but the American people never knew the source of their war news until the conflict was over." Mr. Ratham of the Providence Journal of Providence, Rhode Island, was notorious for his accounts of German crimes. The Boston Herald of December 30th, 1923, in an editorial comment says, quote, "It is, of course, true, as most well-informed people now understand, that the Ratham disclosures, which made the Providence Journal famous during the war, were fiction. But Ratham did this for the praiseworthy support of arousing his countrymen to a war fury. He took one of the practical ways of doing it so. Captain Ferdinand Toy of the British Circus Secret Service in the Secret Corps says in his book, "All the trickery and subterfuge and war wisdom of the ages brought up to date, intensified and harnessed to every modern invention and device. A Machiavelli, a Talleyrand, or some other master schemer of the ages come back to earth would have thrilled at the amazing cunning and corruption of it all," unquote. The Belgium authorities themselves had denied the truth of the crimes given out in the Rice Report. Mr. Lloyd George has stated in print that careful investigation disclosed no case of Belgian children with hands cut off. Yet these are some of the crimes with which the American public were fed during 1916, 17, and 18. The peoples of the Central Powers were, of course, furnished similar crimes attributed to the Allies. There were many crimes committed, as in all wars, but every nation, including the United States, was guilty of them. It is not easy to explain the attitudes of many prominent officials in the United States during the years preceding our entrance into the war. Ambassador Walter H. Page, our representative to London, was guilty of direct disloyalty to the American government and the people. When President Wilson protested to the British government about her regard of neutral rights, Mr. Page did not give the messages to Sir Edward Grey of the British Foreign Office. He would read them to him and would then ask Grey to cooperate with him in making a reply to the United States. Sir Edward Grey says in his memoirs, quote, "Page came to see me at the Foreign Office one day and produced a long dispatch from Washington contesting our claims to act as we were doing in stopping contraband and going to neutral ports. "I am instructed," he said, "to read this dispatch to you." He read. I listened. He then said, "I have now read the dispatch, but I do not agree with it. Let us consider how it should be answered. In all diplomacy, there is no other example of such a procedure." Page was determined upon our entrance from the very beginning of the war. Many of our representatives at the principal courts of Europe were connected with the Allies personally through business or banking interests in this country. Mr. Wilson himself was pro-British in a scholarly way. He was a great admirer of the cabinet parlementary form of government used in England. All his heroes were political science were English authorities. Mr. Wilson's former Attorney General, Thomas W. Gregory, said in a letter to the New York Times of February 9, 1925, that Wilson was, by inheritance, tradition, and reasoning, at all times the friend of the Allies. Mr. Tumultree also now says that Mr. Wilson was never neutral. President Wilson had become converted to the idea of intervention in the spring of 1916. Sir Edward Grey says in his memoirs that Colonel House, now that was an interesting individual, and you read about him in a lot of other books. He was literally running the White House. Assured him on February 16 that Wilson would do his best to bring the United States to the aid of the Allies. In April 16, 1916, the president consulted Champ Clark, Speaker of the House, Claude Kitchen, Democratic leader, and H.D. Flood, Chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, and other Democratic leaders regarding their willingness to bring the United States into the war on the Allies' side. This is known as the famous Sunrise Conference. They refused, and Mr. Wilson allowed his party to use the 1916 slogan, "He kept us out of war." At the time, he was afraid to advocate intervention for fear of splitting his party. There were demands on parts of certain political leaders and the press for immediate intervention, but these demands were not representative of the public opinion at the time. Ambassador Page brought his influence to bear on preventing the Allies from considering German proposals for a peace offering in 1916 and 17. Allied propaganda represented Germany as lustful for world dominion. Careful examination now shows that there is no such policy except that which is common to all powers. This was part of the false propaganda spread in the United States to inflame public opinion and make our entrance defensive. Both sides resorted to trickery of every description. Much stir was created by Zimmerman, note published in March 1917. It was a proposal by Germany to Mexico to enter on the side of Germany should the United States join the Allies with a view to recovering New Mexico and the surrounding territory taken by the United States from Mexico in 1848. But this was exactly what the Allies had done when they persuaded Japan to enter into order in order to capture the German sphere of influence in Chentung, China. It is obvious that every nation at war will try to weaken its opponent. We encouraged the Latin American republics to declare war on Germany, which was no more than Germany did in encouraging Mexico to declare war on the United States, should we declare war on Germany. This note was distorted and reported in 1917 in a manner to give the impression that Germany was actively trying to create trouble for the United States even in peace. The fact remains that the Zimmerman proposal was not to apply unless we entered the war against Germany, when it would be a legitimate defensive measure for Germany to secure the aid of Mexico. Brigadier General J.C. Charteris, Chief of Intelligence of the British Army, during the war, stated boastfully in New York in an address in the fall of 1925 before the National Arts Club that he had invented the report that Germany was boiling down bodies of her dead soldiers to be used as fertilizer. He made the statement under the impression that no reporters were present. Richmond Times-Dispatch on December 6, 1925, said editorially, "Not the least of the horrors of modern warfare is the propaganda bureau, which is an important item in the military establishment of every nation. Neither is it the least of many encouraging signs which each year add to our probability of eventual peace on earth. The famous cadaver story, which aroused hatred against the Germans to the boiling point in this and other allied nations during the war, has been denounced as a lie in the British House of Commons. Months ago, the world learned the details of how this lie was planned and broadcasted by the efficient officer in the British Intelligence Service. Now we are told that the imbued with the spirit of the Locarno Pact, Sir Austen Chamberlain, rose in the House, said that the German Chancellor had denied the truth of the story and that the denial had been accepted by the British government. A few years ago, the story of how the Kaiser was reducing human corpses to fat aroused the citizens of this and other enlightened nations to a fury of hatred. Normally, sane men double their fists and rush off to the nearest recruiting sergeant. Now they're being told, in effect, that they were dupes and fools, that their own officers deliberately goaded them to the desire to the boiling point using an infamous lie to arouse them, just as a grown bully whispers to one little boy that another little boy said he could lick him." And you see how this ties to things like 9/11 and how we got into invading Iraq and all that. They never stop using these same tactics. That's why you should not involve yourself. Don't join up. The encouraging sign found in this revolting admission of how modern warfare is waged is the natural inference that the modern man is not over-eager to throw himself at his brother's throat at the simple word of command. His passions must be played upon, so the propaganda bureau has taken its place as one of the chief weapons. In the next year, propaganda must be more subtle, clever, and the best world war can produce. These frank admissions of wholesale lying on the part of trusted governments in the last war will not soon be forgotten," unquote. And that was from the Richmond Times-Dispatch newspaper. "After the United States entered the war in April 1917, we immediately created a government propaganda bureau, which was known as the Committee on Public Information, with George Creel as chairman. Since the war, Mr. Creel has given us an account of propaganda activities in his book, quote, How We Advertised America, unquote. No effort was made to present the truth. Allied propaganda was accepted, and to it we added ours. This Committee of Public Information issued 75 million pamphlets and books to encourage the public morale. They hired the services of 75,000 speakers who operated in 5,200 communities. Although about 755,000 speeches were made by these people known as the Four-Minute Men, exhibits were given at fairs, war films were prepared for the cinema, from which the Committee on Public Information received a royalty. A total of 1,438 drawings were employed to arouse popular hatred. These official daily newspapers was issued, which had a circulation of 100,000 copies. A propaganda bureau was established by the United States in the capitals of every nation in the world except those of the Central Powers. The total expenditure by the United States for propaganda in the war was $6,738,223. See George Creel's book, How We Advertised America, Chapter 1. This was the greatest fraud ever sold to the public in the name of patriotism and religion. The Espionage Act was passed and making it illegal to spread false reports that would hinder recruitment. Every report was false, which did not harmonize with the propaganda released by this Committee on Public Information. The best we can now say for Mr. Wilson and the American public is that they were victims of Allied propaganda and contributed to the wrecking of European civilization through deception. And that's the end of that chapter. So there you go. Same thing happened, of course, in all wars. The first victim is the truth by the use of propaganda. And they use it on us all the time. Every time something comes up, I don't care whether it's Korea, Vietnam, you know, First World War, Second World War, see how they did the dirty Germans in both wars and all that kind of stuff. So that's it, boys and girls. If that doesn't get to you, I don't know what will, about how wasteful and silly it is to march off to war for any of these goddamn predatory capitalists and their political allies and arms makers, bankers, all that stuff. It all ties together. People make fortunes. They don't care how many people die in a war. If you think that there's anybody there making all this money that cares about how many people die in a war, on your side or their side, you're foolish. You're foolish. These people are beyond contempt. They are totally on contempt. And instead of people running around in the streets shooting each other, they probably all should band together and go to the centers of commerce and do their shooting there. And not of the people at the stores either. You know, like the IRA made the mistake of bombing department stores and things, which was totally insane. I mean, you know, the one. When they went after Mountbatten, that was an act of war. But when they went after, when they start bombing department stores, and like they're bombing all over the Middle East, people's houses, stores, everything, well, that's insane. It's insane. But now we white people are the most propagandized people in the world. I mean, they've spent billions on race mixing, billions, and they've achieved quite a bit, but not near as much as you'd think. Because even after spending billions and billions of dollars for integration and their so-called diversity, there's still millions of white people who are not buying into it. They may not be joining up with us or anything like that, but they're not buying into the crap. Well, the latest word this morning from Israel is they're breeding themselves right off the map. Between the Orthodox Jews breeding like mad and taking advantage of the welfare rules, and the Arab Israelites breeding like mad, property values are going through the roof. People have invested in all these apartments, and people are waiting for months and months and months trying to get an apartment. And so Israel has got not only a population problem, but they got a demographic problem, which is going to get worse and worse and worse. Just thought I'd let you know. Hey, let's look in on China a little bit, you know, that's doing so wonderful. It's as wonderful in China. The rise and fall of China. And, of course, every trillion they went up in income and GNP, United States citizens went down that much. And the working class here goes into poverty as the Chinese gain a lot of money and a lot of things they wanted. But listen to this.
In the last three decades, a remarkable change has transformed the face of the world's most populous country. The figures are mind-boggling. Since 1980, China's gross domestic product has increased by over 3,000%, from $300 billion to over $10 trillion. This boom has been fueled by the remarkable rise of China's manufacturing sector, symbolized by the ubiquitous Made in China mark on seemingly every factory-made product. In 1988, China's global trade was valued at $200 billion. Today, it is worth over $4 trillion. This has led to a now familiar narrative. From a primarily poor and agrarian country, China is now increasingly urban, with a burgeoning middle class enabled by the Chinese Communist Party's relaxation of rules on private capital. This, we are told repeatedly, has led to more people being lifted out of poverty than ever before in the history of the world.
China is honoring former leader Deng Xiaoping for engineering the country's rapid economic growth. Chen Weixiao is from Deng's home province of Sichuan. He says Deng's economic reforms made life better for ordinary Chinese.
We're eating well and we have nice clothes to wear. It's a well-off society. Everything is good. I'm very happy.
Chen was a tourist in the southern city Shenzhen. The city was China's first special economic zone, which offered preferential treatment for foreign investors and exporters wanting to cash in on the country's cheap labor.
The thing that they've done over the past three decades is lifting hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, you know, and I think that that's a good achievement. And the
same time they put millions of other people, especially in the United States, into poverty because it's all cheap labor. It's all slave labor as a capitalism. America loves capitalism, don't they? Yeah, right. Well, capitalism is predatory and it cares for nothing but profits. And if you think that you can bet your race on capitalism, you're a fool.
Last 10 years, there's been more attempt to secure the interests of disadvantaged people and of relatively poor people in the countryside.
As compelling as this narrative is, it does not tell the whole story. While no one can deny that the country as a whole is significantly wealthier than it was three decades ago, the masses of poor itinerant workers remain largely impoverished, dividing their lives between long hours in sweatshop-like factories and restless nights in squalid, overcrowded company dormitories.
For the time being, China's most significant contribution to the global economy remains cheap, reliable labor. Anyone who's ever worked an assembly line can tell you about the pressure and the boredom and the fatigue.
Conditions in the factories have often been harsh. Poor safety, illegally long working hours, cramped accommodation, few breaks, and little leave.
An undercover investigation into the world's largest electronics company, Samsung, by the human rights organization China Labor Watch has revealed that abuse of workers is rife in factories either owned by Samsung or in those that make parts for Samsung products. Eight factories were investigated, including six directly operated by Samsung and two supplier plants by spies posing as workers or interviewing workers. They found forced and excessive child labor, excessive overtime, exhausting working conditions, and widespread verbal and physical abuse.
This story, the story of the brutal conditions that make the world's cheap plastic products possible, and the desperation of the workers who make them, has threatened to burst through the bubble of first world ignorance before. In 2012, the issue of the suicide problem at electronics manufacturer Foxconn, with over 1 million employees across China and 400,000 in Shenzhen alone, became headline news when it was brought to the public's attention by Mike Daisy and his one-man show, The Agony and the Ecstasy of Steve Jobs, which detailed his experience traveling to Shenzhen with an interpreter and interviewing the company's workers.
In my first 2 hours of my first day at that gate, I met workers who were 14 years old. I met workers who were 13 years old. I met workers who were 12. Do you really think Apple doesn't know?
When Daisy's story was eventually found to contain errors and fabrications, the issue of Foxconn's treatment of its workers disappeared from the news cycle. But the reality underlying that story, a reality of long hours and poor pay and suicide nets, disappeared with it.
The suicide nets went up in the spring of 2010 when 9 Foxconn workers jumped to their deaths in the span of 3 months. A total of 18 employees took their own lives or tried to in recent years.
Some striking news. An employee of Foxconn Technology Group attempted to kill himself by cutting his veins Thursday in South China's Shenzhen City. He survived after medical treatment. Well, the suicide attempt came after 12 Foxconn employees had tried to end their lives, and 10 had succeeded by falling from buildings so far this year.
A tragic state of affairs, and in response, Foxconn has taken action to ensure...
So, anyhow, I sent you the entire recording of that with our show today, so you can listen to the whole thing. My main point is capitalism is not going to solve the problems of your race or my race, period. In fact, the problems they create are much larger than the problems that they take care of.
Prosecutors charge a Roseland man for a stabbing and attempted robbery in the city's West Loop. It happened late Sunday night on the Washington Street Bridge. Police say Leroy Willis walked up to Todd Light, announced the robbery, uttered a derogatory racial statement. Light was able to fight back and scream for help. A witness walking helped hold on to Willis until police arrived.
He was standing right behind me. He reached around me with a knife, and when I turned, he stabbed me. Said he hated white people. Give me your wallet. Then he stabbed me again. If the guy had had anything besides that cheap steak knife, and if he'd known how to use it, I would be in serious trouble.
Light was stabbed several times in the stomach, but is now recovering.
Gee, maybe non-whites are beginning to be charged with hate crimes. That's interesting. How they say far right all over the place, especially in Europe. Well, with us black that did the hate crime on a white guy, it says a far south side man. That's an interesting description. A far south side Negro. Well, I see they're going after the death penalty on Dylan Roof, who shot up the black people in Detroit and down south there.
U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch said in a statement on Tuesday that the Justice Department would seek the death penalty for Dylan Roof. 22-year-old Roof is accused of shooting and killing 9 black churchgoers during a Bible study in Charleston, South Carolina last June. Lynch said the nature of the alleged crime compelled the department's decision to seek capital punishment. Roof, who authorities accuse of having white supremacist values, faces 33 federal charges, including hate crimes and firearms charges.
Somebody asked me how to contact this guy, but I checked the federal prison roster and I didn't get it. His name didn't come up.
Is the Charleston church shooter.
That's right. Dylan Roof could be on death row if he's convicted within the last 2 hours. We've learned federal prosecutors will indeed seek the death penalty against the accused Emmanuel AME church shooter. A motion was filed today with the intent to seek the death penalty. It points to several reasons why, including the Fed's belief that Roof had planned out the massacre, that several of his victims were vulnerable in their older age, the attempt to incite more violence afterwards, the racial motivation of the crime, and Roof's perceived lack of remorse. Roof is facing 33 federal charges, accused of killing 9 people inside Mother Emanuel last June. His federal trial date has not yet been set. Roof, though, is already facing the death penalty in his state trial that is set to begin in January.
This is how far they'll go on a hate crime charge. 14-year-old Jew boy who was arrested. No, this was not a Jew. A 14-year-old boy was arrested Monday night for stealing a 13-year-old yeshiva Jewish boy's religious hat in the Crown Heights section of Brooklyn. Wanted to win a bet he made with his friend, sources told JP Wednesday. He was probably a black kid that took the poor little Jew's hat. The teen, identified by sources as Adam Eason, was walking with a group of friends Monday afternoon on the Eastern Parkway when they saw Mendel Kanoski on the other side of the street. The group even made some kind of bet that Eason walked over to the other side of the street and stole Kanoski's hat from his head, the sources said. Quote, it's very obvious they chose the boy because of his religion. Instigators spoke with several witnesses who described seeing the group of kids laughing when their friends stole the hat, a police official said. So they're charging him with hate crime, man, for stealing that little kid's hat. Boy, they used to steal my hat all the time at school. Nobody went after them on account of me. I remember they used to, on the school bus, there was one guy, sort of a bully, used to grab my hat and throw it out the window of the school bus. Pissed me off. Wow. Now down in Louisiana, where the froggies grow, they're going to expand hate crime laws to include the police bill. It's similar to the federal proposal. Well, Louisiana is poised to become the first state in the nation to expand its hate crime laws to protect the police and the firefighters. Yeah. How's that going to work? You see, if a cop is arresting a guy for speeding and the guy that's being arrested yells, "You're a dirty cop," does that mean they both get arrested? See, some congressman is trying to get a bill through to make it a federal crime to exhibit a swastika. Wow. Well, Hollywood's changing things, man. Hollywood reworks the Muslim stereotypes. Muslims have been portrayed as good or bad in many films and television shows, but Hollywood is moving to change this by asking Muslims to become a part of the creative process. Oh, write the scripts. You remember Desmond Tutu, the black archbishop from South Africa that caused so much trouble for white people and still's causing it? Well, his daughter quit the priesthood after marrying a woman. The Reverend Pomo Tutu told local media that since the Anglican Church of South Africa does not recognize her marriage, she could no longer serve it. There you go. Richard Dawkins piped up and he said, quote, "I'm all for offending people's religion," unquote, says the famous atheist or freethinker in a new interview following his mild stroke, adding, quote, "Rationality ought to be polite and humorous. Aggressive atheism or freethinking is sometimes attributed to me, but I think wrongly." Well, it's about time an Israeli Jew man says God is mean. So he asked a judge in a Haifa court for a restraining order to protect him from the Almighty. The man said he had called the local police for help at least 10 times in the last 3 years. The Times of Israel reported Wednesday. The story was first reported on Walla, an Israeli web portal. Well, that'll show God. Tell him, man. The man represented himself in court. No attorney for God was present. Quote, he argued that over a 3-year period, God had exhibited a seriously negative attitude towards him. Although details of just what divine mischief he had borne and the brunt of were not mentioned in the report, according to the Israeli Times, or the Times of Israel. The judge declined the request for a restraining order and called it ludicrous. Well, I don't think so. God has faced legal challenges before. In India this year, the Hindu god Hanuman was summoned to court to answer claims that a temple dedicated to him was blocking traffic. A Kenyan man sued Italy and Israel in 2013 for the crucifixion of Jesus. And Nebraska State Senator Ernie Chambers sued God for natural disasters in 2007. In the Nebraska case, God answered the suit. The Associated Press reported a filing from the Almighty, quote, miraculously appeared on the counter, and it was just all of a sudden was there. Poof. Wow. No such miracle occurred for the Israeli man who the judge suggested needed help, but not from the court. Hello, Bill O'Reilly got his tit in a ringer. He implied that Freddie Gray, the Negro that got his back busted in a police van that they're trying to hang the cops for, he's to blame for his own death. Well, that's interesting, O'Reilly. You may be right. Boys and girls, that's about it for today. I'll be back with you tomorrow on Thursday. You get ready, because I'll probably have something pretty exciting. I'll tell you, I got an exciting song to close out. Yeah. One of the old-timers yesterday was asking me about the old outhouse up on the hill. I played this song before, and I like this song, but a lot of you young people probably don't know much about this, but boy, I sure do.
They passed an ordinance in the town. They said we'd have to tear it down. That little old shack out back so dear to me. Though the health department said its day was over and dead, it will stand forever in my memory. Don't let them tear that little brown building down. Don't let them tear that precious building down. Don't let them tear that little brown building down. For there's not another like it in the country or the town. It was not so long ago that I went tripping through the snow out to that house behind my old hound dog, where I'd sit me down to rest like a snowbird on his nest and read the Sears Roebuck catalog. I would hum a happy tune peeping through the quarter moon, as my daddy's kin had done before. It was in that quiet spot daily cares could be forgot. It gave the same relief to rich and poor. Don't let them tear that little brown building down. Don't let them tear that precious building down. Don't let them tear that dear old building down. For there's not another like it in the country or the town. Now it was not a castle fair, but I could dream a future there and build my castles to the yellow jacket's drone. I could orbit around the sun, fight with General Washington, or be a king upon a golden throne. Now he's seen one of them, I know. It wasn't fancy built at all. We had newspapers on the wall. It was air conditioned in the winter time. It was just a humble hut, but its door was never shut, and a man could get inside without a dime. Don't let them tear that little brown building down. Don't let them tear that precious building down. Don't let them tear that dear old building down. For there's not another like it in the country or the town.
Come to think of it, I think that little old house out back was built better than the main house, man. That was a Sears Roebuck catalog house. It was from Sears Roebuck, believe it or not. So that little outhouse was built better than that house.